My name is Jack. I'm from Joaquin Franzlac in Columbia University. First, I want to thank Clint and Bridget invite me to the workshop. 3 years ago, in 2014, I was just joining the lab, and I didn't get a chance to go to the NREM meeting in San Diego. But I go through all the slides and video. I think it's really a terrific resource for beginner to acquire the basic knowledge and the latest developments. So I have two questions to address today. So the first one is, how can time-resolved CryEM help you in your research? And the other is, what are the obstacles to success? But to be honest, I think, I think I really have to tell you is there are more and more issues rather than the success. And actually, I want to have your suggestions rather than have you in your research. So please listen to carefully to my talk so you can contribute a lot. So the first thing is, what is the definition in terms of time-resolved CryEM? In our opinion is, we know some knowledge about single molecule, single particle CryEM analysis now, and we want to combine this knowledge with the ability to dissect the time progress of a reaction between molecules. So, for example, you have one molecule A, and then you want to have a look at the interaction between molecule A and molecule B. So, you really get a product, like say once in seconds or minutes. And usually they go through an intermediate state. And our focus is actually the intermediate. So that's the really interesting part. And that also tells you what is the mechanism of the biological reaction. And based on the kinetics of the reaction, you can have the lifetime of intermediates from minutes to microseconds. So it's also expanded, not only limited to two molecule reaction, it can also involve in a change of the environment, like the light, some protein are respond to light, and also some protein are respond to pH changes, ionic strength, absolute temperature, so on. So, actually, I have a first question for you is, what could be the best sample to test all the all these conditions? So you can think about a good example for me. So I want to show you what has been tested before. So the first paper came out in 1993 from Serum and Richard Henderson lab. What they uses the electron diffraction method to look at the bacterial rhodopsin in the photo cycle. So this is their experiment setup. You really have a plunger, and this goes to at speed 2 meters per second, so it's really fast. And they have a light source which shine light on the bacteria rhodopsin. And the distance they have here is really small, so they can capture intermediates in 4 milliseconds. Oh, my computer stopped. Sorry. Oh, the other thing I want to mention is, so the next paper from John Berryman and Nigel and Wayne, also from MRC. This time they look at another system rather than using the light as a trigger. They use a small molecule. So they work with acetylcholine receptor. They put the molecule on the grid first, and then they spray some small chemicals to trigger the conformational change of this receptor. So they can also demonstrate the conformational change happens within 10 milliseconds. So in 1995, Howard White started to build this computer-controlled machine to achieve this time-resolved CryEM idea. So they also look at an another system, and they were also able to capture the intermediates. So the problem, well, the limitation for their system is first you have put on the grid for first molecule, and then you have to spray or use a light to trigger the direction. So that that requires you to have a mixture on the grid. So the mixing happens on the grid depends on the diffusion rate. So the diffusion is really slow because it also depends on the molecule weight. So you are thinking to mix two large molecules, and then that will really slow down your kinetics. Okay. So our way out of this is we want to mix first and then spray the sample out. So our idea is to use the microfluidic chip. So the experiment design is like this. So you have a microfluidic chip. It has two ports for inject solutions. So this is a real picture of that. So you can see the microfluidic chip is here, and then you have two ports for liquid. And then we have to use a nitrogen gas to spray out the droplets. And first, you have two solutions goes into the microfluidic chip. And then the first thing you want to have is a mixer. So that's why we use this micro mixer to mix the two samples. This micro mixer is only very short in length. The scale is 500 micrometer. So these two picture shows you at different flow rates, you really have different mixing efficiency. So to achieve 100%, you really have to go with very high flow rates, like 6 microliter per second. And that gives you about 0.5 milliseconds to mix everything. And this is a demonstration. We mix the 70S ribosome with ferritin molecules. So this picture is took at the CCD camera. So it's very not high resolution. And then after the mixing, what we want to do is to control the reaction time. So how do we achieve that? We have different chips with different lengths of the reaction channel. So with different reaction channel, and you have a fixed flow rate, so the reaction time is controlled in that way. And then after the sample spread out on the grid, we have a step motor driven plunger. It plunged the grid into the cryogen to stop the reaction. So that takes about 18 milliseconds. So the problem for us is how do we control the ice thickness? To get high resolution, the main thing you have to work with is to get thin ice. So if you think about the sprayer and then all the different sizes of the droplets are coming out of the sprayer, and then you have a cryo-EM go through the plume of the droplets, and then they contact with your grid. And then the grid will bring all the droplets into the cryogen. So if you think about the blotting method, you really have good control of the ice thickness over the whole grid. So this is an example of the blotting grid we got from the VitroBot. So it's very nice. You have a gradient, thick ice region, and thin ice region. Probably those are empty holes. But if you look at this body, the spray grid, you really have a lot of large droplets. They never wick very well. And if you look closer, you may find some good squares that the ice is thin enough to collect data. And also you can have, if your spray is too strong, then sometimes you also can break down, the carbon film. So this is a SEM image of the Confoil R1.2.1.3 grid. So this is showing just one square. What I want to point out is you have about maybe 3 micron height on the gray bar. So that's what I think is weakening the droplet. So I will show you what I mean by that. So comparing with the blotting grid, so this is a square, right? So sometimes we get an image that looks like this. So you have very thick ice region in the center, and then you may have a little bit thinner region near the grid bar. And if you think about this in a different angle, so that's what I imagine about this image. So this part is the grid bar, which shows in the black region. And then you have a slope of the ice thickness. And this part is still the position where you like collect data. And we can never get any image in this region. And sometimes you get lucky, you get maybe half of the square covered by thin ice. And also sometimes if the ice is really thin, you get the empty hole. And in the perfect example, what we'll get is a square fully covered by thin ice, which I'm gonna show in the next slide. Okay, so we really, only maybe have two or three over the whole grid, like have ice like this. The other thing we found very interesting is even within one hole, we have a distribution of ice thickness. So on the left side, you have a thicker ice, and on the right side, you have a thin ice. And we can quantify the ice thickness by drilling a hole and tilt it 30 degrees to measure the ice thickness. And this happens all the time. We make our spring grids, and we think this is correlated with the grid, the plunging direction of the grid. What's that? Oh, you mean the plunging speed? We never test that, but this could be the reason.
This is going a bit off topic. Maybe we should talk over beer on that.
So for the data collection, we can automatically collect data with Legendon. So first you have to identify the good square and then good region to collect data and queue up all the targets. So with that, it's pretty easy to done. And we have some idea about how to control the ice thickness. Because we are spraying out the sample, and the droplet size is really controlled by mainly two factors. So the first one is the flow rate of your liquid, and the other is the flow rate of your gas, so the nitrogen gas we use. And we varied the gas pressure from 16 psi to 48 psi, so that can give you a different flow rate of the gas. And by this formula, we can calculate roughly what's the mean diameter of the droplets. It's varied from 36 to 4.4 micrometer, and corresponding the volume is 24 picoliter and less than 1 picoliter. And we did a comparison at this four different conditions, from 16 psi to 24 to 33 to 48 psi. And we quantified ice thickness where we really collect data. And to our surprise is with smaller gas pressure, which gives you slower flow rate of the gas, you have a thinner ice distribution compared to a higher speed, higher flow rate. And we quantify the droplet size, the distribution of droplet. So at lower flow rate, you have maybe 42% of the very small droplet. And as you go higher with the flow rate, you get more and more small droplet. And 2.5 micrometer droplet is really not good for us for to get thin ice. We find out the best range of the droplet size is from maybe 2.5 to 30 micron. And that's the, really the 16 psi condition gives you the maximum. And we use 16 psi to test our test sample epiferritin, and we can get 3 angstrom. And we also test another membrane protein. This is 360 kilodalton membrane protein, and we can solve to 3.7 angstrom. So I will show you some slides out of this topic, but I'm really excited to show you the result. We did a blotting grids on this sample, and we solved to 3.2 angstrom. And because of the purification method, we didn't use any detergent in the purification. So what we find out is there is a bilayer patch inside this membrane. So this part is the transmembrane domain. And inside there is a cavity. And in the density, we find out a complete bilayer of lipid molecule. So I'll just turn it around for you to look at it. OK, so if you take a section on this part and tilt it 90 degrees, so you can see the cross-section. And we found the other interesting thing is all the lipid molecule is packed in a hexagonal pattern. And this has been hypothesized before. And this is our experiment data to show this is really the case for lipid packing. OK, so I have shown you our success in spring out one sample and get high resolution. So back to the time results cryo-EM data. Well, there are two systems we look at. The first one is the recycling process of the 7TS ribosome. So in this recycling process, you have a complete 7TS, and then two factors bind to the 7TS, then split into two subunits, 30S and 50S. So we start from the initial complex, and we add two factors to mix them and let them react for a certain time. So from the kinetics prediction is you can get the interest complex, the intermediates, within 20 milliseconds. And that's what we test out. So we can get a high resolution structure at 7.4. So this published in 2016. And we did a quantification. We collected the different time points and pull out all the data together to get an idea how the reaction happens over time. And the other question for you is the quantification we find out is really hard to reproduce. So it's all of the process can contribute differently to the quantification result. So like particle peaking and how do you do the classification and how do you discard the bad classes? So I think that's also a question for you. Anyway, we got a quantification of the split reaction. So this is just the quantification of 50S or 70S plus 50S. So you can see over time, at different time point, you have a different ratio and the increasing, and it's matching our kinetics prediction. And the other reaction we look at is the initiation process. So it's like the reverse of recycling. You have two subunits and they come together to join to form 7TS. So we start with 30S complex and we mixed them with 50S. So at the first two time points, 20 milliseconds and 60 milliseconds, you get an intermediate structure, which F1 is already gone, and F2 is still bind to the 70S. And at 200 millisecond and 600 millisecond, the F2 leaves, and the 70S ribosome is ready to go into the next phase. Okay, so in the long term of this project, we want to have a more general application of this method. And we want to use a less sample and maybe try an even smaller system to achieve this time result cryo-EM idea. And the other goal is to have even shorter mixing time and even shorter freezing time. But it's really hard to get that. So what we have now is another whole chip, the time resolve chip, based on the PDMS. So we think we can maybe just build more those devices and have other labs who are interested in this method. And you can just do one experiment and then discard the chip. And you want to repeat, and you can get another one. So this one, this PDMS-based microfluidic chip is very easy to produce. So that's the benefit. OK, so that's all about my time resolve talk. I have another slide to show. So in 2014, Stephen Lukin come up with this diagram to show the signal-to-noise ratio at different frequency region. And we recently collected the data on the CREOS in OSBC. And we have 2-day session. The first day is there's some problem with the energy filter, so we don't have any slit in there. And they fixed the problem. So the second day, we collected another data set with 20 EV slit. And the blue is from the first day data. There's no energy slit. And on second day, we get the red dots. So this this x-axis is the low frequency from 20 to 200 angstrom. And you can see with the energy filter, you really boost up all the low frequency signal to noise ratio. It's hard to say how much you can gain for the high frequency region. Okay, so with that, I want to mention the our lab members. So Sandeep is our postdoc, also worked with me on the time result method. Bo was the post was a graduate student who graduated, who also worked a lot on the on this project. And Ming, she's now in UCSF. So if you are also interested in this project, you can talk to her too. And all the initiation data we collected is a collaboration with Ruben's lab, and the recycling data was collaborating with Monks. And the design the 3D sprayer and the microfluidic chip was collaborating with Dr. Lin in mechanical engineering department in Columbia. And the whole experiment setup was helped with Dr. White. Okay, I think I'm done.
Questions? Rado? Anybody?
Sorry, can you just go back to your last slide there? This is interesting data, but I didn't understand it. Can you explain it again?
So this is like an estimation of your micrograph quality. So it's first you have to do is to do your CTF estimation to pick your particle. So in EMAN 2, I think you can estimate the signal to ratio around your particle. So each dot stands for one micrograph. So you can see the red, so the two axes, one is low frequency signal to the ratio, and this is high frequency. So if you have clusters on this region, that means your data is really good. So if you have a micrograph in this region, that means they are bad in quality.
benefits to the CTF function?
I think maybe Steve is the best person to.
Steve?
I don't want to try and explain that right now.
Is people getting tired, huh? Cold, I know. Nico said he thought it was getting a bit warmer, but I'm not sure.
It's all mental.
Okay, then.
So, question follow up this figure. So, have you manually look at the feeding of your CTF instead of just like run out everything automatic to see if the background really fits? Otherwise, this is not meaningful.
So this is so you are worrying about the background of the CTF, right? So you have this correction. How this work is you subtract the background, so it's only comparing the. Yes. No, I haven't checked it. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm.
Okay.
So I'm sort of thinking out loud, and this might be way off base, but my intuition is that that doesn't make sense because the filter should be removing shot noise, the electrons that go straight through the specimen, or sorry, the inelastically scattered electrons, and they'll be randomly placed in the image, and that should be high frequency noise they remove. Chris is agreeing with me. We're disagreeing. I'd like to hear your response.
There was somebody before you. Can I give it to
it's
me?
Not random. So the inelastic electrons have a certain angular spread, which is different from the elastic ones. It's very concentrated towards the center, so it's not going to put a white noise spectrum in the background. It's going to be something complicated, and I don't know if we know exactly what that is. I don't think it's been measured accurately. Maybe Nico knows. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you essentially you get a dark field image. So the energy loss image that you would get at 20 electron volt loss will still show your sample very blurry, very low resolution, with opposite contrast. So that is signal opposite to the bright field image that you're collecting. So it's
removing the inelastic electrons should remove signal at low resolution.
But it's opposite contrast, so it would.
The trouble with the inelastics is they're not focused properly by the objective lens because of the chromatic aberration. But if the chromatic aberration weren't there, then they would actually contribute signal. So it's not a white, noise spectrum. But I don't know what the noise spectrum actually is. So.
Discuss it at a coffee and tell us at the panel.
Or tomorrow's panel might even be more.
I was just wondering a little bit more about your classification results, and you were mentioning, I guess, some instability and convergence behavior, and maybe you can talk a little bit more about that and what you were seeing affecting that and what the magnitude of the effect is.
What we have done is we manually check every micrograph to make sure the particles we picked are really particle, not the contamination. So that's the first thing we do. And the second is we do 2D classification, to make sure the particles are aligned properly. And in the 3D classification, we ran it multiple times just to get a consistency in the 3D classification. So that's how we deal with this problem.
How different are the results? Like how many particles do you see jumping around between classes?
So the error bar is about 10 to 15%. So that's from a different range of 3D classification, not involving reprocess the data.